is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? And it is Musical May this month. We'll be focusing on movies with a musical theme. Originally, I was going to say musical movies, but they're not all like musicals, because we're starting out this week with Muriel's Wedding from 1994. It's written and directed by PJ Hogan, who also did My Best Friend's Wedding. And it stars Toni Collette, Rachel Griffiths, and Bill Hunter. Bill Hunter was filming Priscilla, Queen of the Desert at the same time as this across the country of Australia and had different beard and hair and had to like travel back and forth between the two movies, which sounds like a movie I would watch just of that experience.
And he's also in Strictly Ballroom, isn't he?
He's in a ton of things. Yeah. He's huge. So PJ Hogan really wanted to use ABBA in this film, ABBA music. And Australians love ABBA. It's a thing. Yeah. So at first they were like, no. And apparently he said that he was going to fly to Europe and plead his case in front of the ABBA guys, I guess. And they said yes, as long as they received a percentage of the profits. And because the film turned out to be a huge hit all over the world, that helped inspire the Broadway show that then became the movie, Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia. Oh my God. I was going to say, this has like, I I've never seen this movie. So I thought like, okay, it's Musical May. We're about to watch a musical. And it wasn't really, there wasn't really any music. And then I saw in her room all the ABBA posters in like those first like 10 minutes. And I was like, oh, this is just going to be a movie with a bunch of ABBA songs in it. There's like, that's its own genre.
Right. But what I think is fun with a certain subgenre within that movies, unless you mean just the genre of ABBA movies, is that it has the ABBA music both diegetically and non-diegetically. So it's both, you know, them listening to it or singing it and as soundtrack, which I think is...
And performing Waterloo.
Yes. And not in a like, hey, this is a small musical theme recurring to remind you of it. It's just like, no, we're gonna ABBA, you know?
So I will say... a friend of mine and I wrote an adaptation of an Italian commedia dell'arte play called The Servant of Two Masters for the theater I work at. And it was a lot of fun. It was very goofy. There's a whole, if you're not familiar, it's like a Shakespearean level plot with fart jokes.
I mean, so Shakespeare has fart jokes too.
Yeah. I mean, but it is, you know, star-crossed lovers and then, you know, the lover kills his betrothed's brother in a duel and then flees and she disguises herself as a man to follow him, you know, all that. So we had a scene where she had to confess her love for Florindo is her boyfriend's name and she thinks he's died. And we just wrote a whole monologue that was basically Fernando. About how they had met and how she loved Florindo. And it was so much fun to, and I was like, oh, this is a thing. People love to put ABBA in media, like in media that's not music.
Because like ABBA, I think there are so many ABBA songs that you can find one for pretty much like any mood or story. But also it's so unapologetically bombastic. And it was so in a time when that music had no status and was like ridiculed, not only in Sweden, but around the world. So like the unapologeticness etude is like even stronger because they're like, it's not just like, hey, we like this thing. It's fun. It's like, we like this thing, even though everyone is making fun of us. Everyone hates us.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, I like ABBA. Not just because I'm Swedish, love ABBA. But I really do. I've met one of the bees in ABBA, at, a book event, which is really fun.
The first or second bee?
The second. I talked to him very briefly and then I was like, you know, it's him and Samuel L. Jackson are my two best. Like I was in the same room and talked to these people because like, how are you going to beat that?
I saw Mark Hamill from about 50 yards away at the Comic Con.
was that big?
It was mind blowing.
The ABBAs. We'll get into it, but I want to give you some more amazing trivia. So PJ Hogan based Muriel's personality on himself, which I love that he admits. But like the plot line was inspired by his sister, who embezzled $15,000 from their father and then disappeared to Sydney to live with a friend.
Oh my God.
Right?
I love that it's kind of based. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can tell it's written from a perspective of understanding a certain class and culture in Australia.
Yeah, and also just like a certain experience and personality type. I love this fact. The French trailer ends with the tagline that... Should I try to say it out loud? On fait un film qui frôle le bon goût sans jamais y tomber. At last, a movie that comes close to good taste, but never gets into it.
Love it.
It's very like sort of John Waters,
yeah.
Monty Python tagline, and I love that.
Yeah, and we'll get into it, but like the movie, I've only ever seen the poster of this movie, and it looks like a very traditional, you know, it's Muriel being showered in confetti in a wedding gown. It looks very much like, I mean, it looks like Mamma Mia.
You know what just occurred to me? When the opening scene in My Best Friend's Wedding, that music video, it has the same like, haha, you think you know what you're getting as yeah. the poster and kind of the first like minutes of this movie does. And then it's like,
yeah,
no, no, no.
Yeah. Well, and it has, there's like a camp factor that starts to fade away in service of like actual character study and even melodrama. And it's this weird mix of different. At first I was like, oh, this is a camp movie. This is a John Waters, but I'm a cheerleader. Like I was getting those vibes. And then as it went along.
Or even like, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Like it's just like underdog, possible Cinderella moment thing.
Yeah. And then as it went on, I was getting even more vibes of like, this is a weird movie to compare it to, but Happiness. Do you know that
movie?
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a very darkly funny and disturbing movie about relationships, but it has this melancholy that runs through it. And I kind of felt that way about this too. There's like a sadness in this movie that like, I don't know. We'll get into it.
Well, I think they also have in common that they are so much about sort of trying to create a facade. And the more you try, the more the supports holding your set pieces up just crumbles.
Yeah, true.
All right. What is this movie about?
Once upon a time, there was a girl named...
Muriel.
Muriel!
Muriel.
Muriel.
Are you Muriel Heslop?
No.
All she ever dreamed about was getting married.
Looks like I'm next.
There was only one thing missing. A groom.
No one's ever gonna marry you. You've never even had a boyfriend.
Muriel's on the doll.
You never wear the right clothes.
You mental case! You keep away from us!
All right, so this is an Australian movie with Toni Collette, who I did not realize was Australian. And... she's kind of unrecognizable in this. Like, it took me a minute, and then like facial expressions, I was like, "Oh,
well,
that's
I think Collette. Like because there's this whole thing about like, oh, she gained 40 pounds in seven weeks to do this role, and it's because there are so many you know layers to that as there often are when actresses gain weight, because it's like usually they go from fairly thin, to
so
this
it's
sort
not-
of. Smallish average size because like looking at her now she's not big like I would say like smaller than your average size woman probably but I see how you know going from like I don't know random numbers here 110 to 150 can be a big deal for you but it's also not a huge thing like 40 pounds sounds so much when you just say it like that and gaining it in 7 weeks is definitely an exercise but it's not like that big a thing so I think it's that she is so much younger here than when she became big in the US.
Yes, that's more where I was going with it.
But I think the weight gain plus the actual baby face with like created baby fat on top takes a
and
while.
Like freckles and red hair, which I don't associate her with at all.
I think it might also be that she, and I would love to be corrected here, but I don't think she's done a lot of like comedic roles in the same way in Hollywood. Like she doesn't really do, she's been in sort of comedies, mm-hmm. like About a Boy, she plays the mom, I think, but like she hasn't done this kind of goofy really that much. And I think that might also be it, because here, like her visage, if we're gonna keep being fancy, no, but like her like facial work, her the way she like holds and uses her face here is so different that I could really see how you'd be like, it would take you a while. It would really be an, oh, hey, it's that guy, you know?
Yeah, the only things I can think of that are like comedies are that she's done that I've seen is like Little Miss Sunshine.
But where she wasn't a goofy comedic.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, she is an amazing dramatic actress, and she definitely is here as well, but just like she plays a goofy character rather than playing it goofily. Like, anyway, do you want to do this in 10 minutes? No? All right. It's about Muriel, Toni Collette.
Yeah. So Toni Collette, it starts off with a bouquet being thrown through the air. Everyone's rushing to catch it. And we are at a wedding. And Muriel, Toni Collette catches it. And all the women are like, oh, what a waste. What a waste of a bouquet. And everyone's just instantly shitty to her. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. And, so she's at this wedding and it's her friend Tanya, who's getting married to a guy named Chuck, which is the Australian version of Chuck. That's my headcanon for that. Australian surfer dude. Yeah. Everyone kind of craps on her and walks away and leaves her stranded at this wedding. It's a very 80s wedding, despite the fact that this is 1994.
I feel like it's, you know, Lex LA Story. In most countries, the 80s went on for longer than we want to admit.
Yeah, yes, that is and, like, true.
Large part of the 90s. Okay, can I run something by you here? Because on the one hand, I identify so strongly with Muriel. And I think a lot of people do. Like, you're kind of supposed to be a little annoyed by her. And that's from, like, so obviously these other girls are huge bitches. They are mean, they are bitchy, but also, like, it's not hard to see how you would find Muriel annoying, and part of that is some sort of weird self-fulfilling thing, like, once you start thinking that you're not cool, but she does also kind of think she's okay, and I think a lot of us, even, you know, losers sometimes have friends, and then you can have that other friend who just tags along, and there's no way to get rid of them, right? And I think... I don't know exactly how that's intended, because you are supposed to hate the actual bridal party, you know, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's also something there where you're like, yes, you're bitchy, but also she doesn't have a right to join them on their trip, right?
Yeah.
Like, yes, it's bitchy to not tell her, but I think a lot of people have had that, like, sort of mental reckoning with yourself where you're like, how do we not, like, actively not tell this person, or how do we bring it up so that it's like an obvious conclusion that they wouldn't come? Because yes, she probably couldn't afford it, but that's a very handy excuse after that. Do you know where I'm going here? Like, it's so hard, because with the sort of perspective of time and possibly having met more people, I'm like, I hate them, but part of me can sort of, maybe not empathize, but I can kind of see it, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, particularly when you're talking about the core group of me girls, is they all have spats with each other, they all have spats with everyone, but then they, like, keep Muriel and Rhonda, who we'll meet in a minute, they keep them, like, in their orbits.
Because you need someone to be better than.
Yeah, and so, I don't know.
Because I think it's also that, because they're like, you know, 21, 22, and that's when you're still, usually I think, kind of maybe still friends with the people you hung out with in high school. And it, I mean, most of these people don't seem to have gone to university. And so it's like you kind of by default keep hanging out with them regardless of how you've changed or not changed, especially in a small town, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. And I know a number of friends in my life, and this isn't any sort of value judgment, but primarily women in friend groups with primarily women who there's like constant antagonism within the group, and it's always only with the groups that they've been friends with since high school.
Because they don't actually like each other, but they haven't.
But
they
it's
don't
like actually they've known each other for 30 years or whatever, and now it's just that. I've noticed that occasionally, but I don't know. I empathize with Muriel, and I also think that the women are so caricaturized, like even at the end, at the very end, the main blonde girl yells after her. She's like, "But I'm beautiful or I'm pretty or something." And she's making just the most horrific, like, monster face.
"You can't say that to me. I'm married. I'm beautiful."
Yeah. And she's just got a horrible, like, evil scowl on her face, and it, like, kind of lingers on it.
They're absolutely cartoon characters. And I mean, you could also sort of read them through Muriel's lens of, like, this is how I remember this
part. So that's
how
that's how I actually read the movie. Like, I read the movie in a way that, like, everything we're seeing is filtered through her perspective, which is maybe slightly warped.
But that's, maybe also her memory.
Or memory, yeah, exactly. Yeah, either one. But yeah, so that's kind of how I picture it, is we are getting her side of the story, and that's it. And that's why it's a little cartoonish until it becomes a little more serious. That's the way the movie imprinted on me, having never seen it before and having no relationship.
Yeah,
with
kind
movie.
Of like once she starts to actually, you know, delve deeper into herself and or humanity, the movie also takes on an actual tone of something.
Yeah.
And I do think it's interesting, though, because it's hard, I think, from our perspective and however many years later, to gauge the class of the mean girls. Like, I think we can kind of tell, like, they're going on this expensive vacation, but also, like, they have jobs and she doesn't. And, they use the honeymoon money. And I think we've talked about this before, maybe, like, that the thing where everyone just kind of agrees on who is the hot girl in high school and, like, who is cool. And it's kind of based around, like, can you do hair, makeup, and pick fashionable clothes? Well, then you're cool. Yeah. Unless you somehow don't get it right by this tiny degree, and then we'll mock you and nobody can figure it. But you know what I mean? Like, they could be kind of above her, quote unquote, because they're of a different class, but they also could not be and just be like, this is a small town and just randomly they're the cool kids.
Yeah, they could be like the kids who were maybe not so cool in high school, and now they've just made themselves the queens of their little smaller pond, you know, post high school. Yeah. I don't know. Well, anyway, we are at
the wedding.
That's wedding.
How far we've gotten.
We're opening scene. These people are awful. When Muriel goes to the bathroom, she sees Chuck having sex with one of the other women in the friend group in the bathroom, and she's like, oh my gosh.
She almost, something about her face almost looks like, you know, when you have sometimes in movies little kids who don't understand what's going on because they don't have the frame of reference for it.
Yeah, it's like, what am I seeing? You can also tell at this wedding, like, she's kind of alone. You know, she doesn't really have a whole lot of, like, social skills. And then one of the wedding guests calls the police and says that Muriel stole the dress she's wearing. So they take her out of they drag her out of the wedding and take her home. And we meet her family, who are, you know, very clearly kind of like a lower class Australian family living in a rural area.
I think they're sort of middle class economically, but possibly not like culturally. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because her dad is some sort of like council building bigwig, or medium wig at least. And I think that's also a very sort of interesting point to make here, that, you know, there is that whole, is it Bourdieu who talks about social, economical, and cultural capital? This podcast just got worse and worse. I'm sorry.
This podcast just became like an
NPR
college
episode.
Class that I slept through.
But like, because I think that is really interesting, like the social capital, cultural capital, and economic or financial capital. And so they can have it, but they don't have the cultural capital, and they don't really have the social capital. The dad sort of does, but the family definitely doesn't. Like most of the adult-ish kids have dropped out of school. They don't have jobs. So that's also a very interesting sort of intersection of people that you don't necessarily see as much, I think, in film, because it's easier to have someone who's like, you could possibly have someone who like goes to college and gets out of poverty, but usually like you need someone who is both uneducated and poor to be able to like make it clear what their role is in the story.
Yeah. And this felt like a certain cultural thing specific to Australia as well. Like this felt like there were probably tropes and patterns and ideas and images that were probably more grafted onto kind of Australian cultural literacy than, but you know, you do kind of get the sense like, we meet Bill, the dad, who's, you know, this kind of brusque politician guy. And then he tells one of the kids to ask their mom to get him a cup of tea. And when we see her, she's just kind of staring off into space in the kitchen while the other kids are, you know, just schlubbing around in the living room. So there's this very, you know, almost reminded me a little of like Malcolm in the Middle too. This kind of like, not Malcolm in the Middle. My Name is Earl.
Okay. Cause I was like, that mom is not passive in Malcolm in the Middle.
No, My Name is Earl. Just in that kind of like, this is trying to capture a specific social.
Well, that's actually level. That would be a really interesting parallel, because doesn't that show start out with him winning a ton of money? So he's like suddenly transported into this context that he doesn't have context for, sort of.
Yeah, an anti-context context. But yeah, anyway, so we meet her family, and yeah, they're I think we can. They're social. They're the outliers of society a little bit, and. The cops are like, show us your receipt for this dress, and she can't find it, but the dad bribes them with a case of beer. And so we're like, oh, dad's a briber. Great. Then we have a lot of scenes with the dad, and there's, you know, him trying to like butter up these Asian businessmen, and, kind of shitting on Muriel for, you know, he sent her to secretarial school, but she can't type. So, you know, he's like, I'm proud of her. He's like, and you can't type. Everyone's just crapping on her. The whole movie is, and that's kind of why I think it's her perspective, is like every scene becomes about how much people are mistreating her. Mm-hmm. Eventually Bill's, friend, quote unquote, Deidre, like kind of loops Muriel into this, MLM. You know, multi-level marketing pyramid scheme thing, and says, you got to write a check for this cosmetics, and then
your starter kit to become a hashtag boss lady.
Oh, yes. And in the meantime, we've had a drink date with the girls, and they tell Muriel she's out of the group. She doesn't get to come on vacation with them. It's very awkward and uncomfortable. Muriel starts crying in the middle of this bar. It's painful. So she has no money and that's mainly the difference, is you're awkward and you're uncomfortable and you're poor. That's like the implicit, here's why you can't be our friends. So multi-level marketing scheme, they're like, you need some money. So dad tells the mom, just write her a blank check and she can cash it, or she can, you know, make it out for whatever she needs. And, when mom's writing the check, Muriel's like, make it out to cash. And so she goes on vacation and she meets up with the girls who just kind of shut her out. And this, I will say, I would also love to see a version of this movie that is just the vacation stuff. Because it reminded me a little bit of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. And I will say, we should add that to our list of chick flicks because it is delightful. And it is about two middle-aged women going on vacation. It is great. But it reminded me a little bit of that. The costumes are incredible. We get a dance scene, a bunch of songs and dances in here. Kind of diegetically in context of the movie. For like competitions, and they're all ABBA songs. So yeah, so Miro's there. She sees the mean girls. They get mad at her for being creepy and like coming along, even though they disinvited her from the thing. And they
again, like, they're bitches.
Not
about
wrong.
It is kind of weird. Like, for a moment, I was like, is my better version of this where she goes somewhere else on vacation? Like, I know that you miss a ton of the really good drama of it.
Yeah.
But just like, yeah.
So while she's on this vacation, she meets Rhonda, who is another high school dropout from the same high school. Oh, I forgot to say the name of their town is Porpoise Spit. I mean, I just love the name. Like, what is my town? It's Dolphin Spit. Like, let's just call it what it is.
And so, Rhonda is Rachel Griffiths, like, speaking of later huge stars.
Yeah. I know. I was watching going, Jenna and I, like, we know that person. And so we had to look. I was like, oh my God. So yeah, she meets Rhonda, and they kind of bond, and, Muriel lies and says she's on a little, like, bachelorette.
Last fling.
Yeah, last fling from her fiance. Oh, the other thing I forgot to tell you is we find out pretty quickly that she is obsessed with weddings. She's dreamed of having a beautiful wedding. She's dreamed of being a bride. So she makes up that she's got a fiance, of course.
Tim Sims.
So she and Rhonda
make about as good as Charlie Orange Juice.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a list of like all the made up boyfriends and girlfriends and fiancés in movies. I think there's probably some great names there. She meets Rhonda. And they form a quick friendship, and they go to confront the mean girls because Rhonda also has issues with them. She's like, what would you say to them? And the mean girls pull that classic mean girl thing where they're like, oh, why don't you just have a drink with us? Like, it's so nice to see you. And Rhonda is like, I would love to, but I don't drink with, you know, stupid crazy ladies that are blah, 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 blah. And she kind of, you know, she plays them, and then she's like, oh, and by the way, your friend slept with your husband.
On your wedding day.
And then we get, I'm going to just call it right here, my favorite scene in the movie. We get a Waterloo performance full of straight-to-camera acting, and even, like, Toni Collette kind of, like, laughing during it.
And it's
like,
so good.
And they're clearly having so much fun, and the costumes are amazing, and at the end of this Waterloo performance, I guess a talent show here at this resort, the mean girls get in another fist fight because we've already seen one of them with the black eye now. I'm sorry, I don't remember any of their names. They just all conglomerate in my mind. While she's on vacation, their family realizes that she has basically taken all of Dad's money to go on this wild vacation. She comes home and her mom is like, oh, your dad's really pissed. And she takes off. She's like, nope, I'm out of here. She goes to Sydney and gets a apartment with Rhonda and a job at a video store where she meets this guy, Bryce. And she brings Bryce home and Rhonda brings these two sailors home. And they're all having fun in one room. Bryce and
this is where actually a really funny detail, because you're the one who's brought up subtitles before, because baby.
Yes.
And here we were watching it with English subtitles, and this happens in a lot of movies, but here it became sort of painfully hilarious. Like when you have stuff that's barely audible or like sort of non-specific in movies, and you'd be like, okay, so now I know exactly what this train announcement was. I don't really care.
Yeah.
But here it is. It's subtitled all of the weird sex talk that's mostly just like, you know, like move over or yeah, you like, and it's just like, so that scene where she is making tea
from the other rooms, and you hear like sail. Yes. So we had subtitles on too and got the same thing.
And it's just, it makes that scene where they're sort of quietly and awkwardly like making tea, opening biscuits, makes it even, like, it is already funny and uncomfortable, but just having those like specified, like,
yeah,
very like.
So, yeah. And then it's even more awkward because, they end up sitting on a, her and Bryce end up sitting on a beanbag chair watching TV. And then her dad's on the TV and her dad's like, Muriel, come home. Like, we're not mad at you. We just want to know that you're safe. And she immediately is like, she turns off the TV and Bryce and her start to make out a little bit. They start to, he thinks he's unzipping her crazy weird leather pants. But he unzips the beanbag chair and all the beanbag stuff flies everywhere. They get all kind of tangled. She starts scream laughing.
Which I think is completely fair.
Which is totally fair. And it's, and then the two sailors come running out buck naked from the room and they're like, what's going on? And they misinterpret the scream laugh.
Because she screams even louder because suddenly American penises in her living room.
So yes, the sailors rush out. They mistake the scream laughs for screams. And I think in a, like a really good scene of like men doing the right thing, they like go to restrain the guy because they're like, okay, something's wrong. And they like, they act. And I'm like, you know, they're misunderstanding.
I mean, it's kind of the, you know, pepper spray first, ask questions later, which I think in, like you're saying, in certain situations.
In that
is,
case, I'm like, okay with it.
Either, because they don't, they, you know, they don't punch him. They just like restrain him.
Yeah. And then
his mouth is full of beanbag beans. And they keep asking her, are you okay, ma'am? Which I think is really cute.
And he's like squatting down with his wiener right in her face, asking her if she's okay. And she keeps scream laughing. And then Rhonda comes out and she starts scream laughing and then she just collapses. And then suddenly we're in an ambulance. We're on our way to the hospital and she can't feel her legs and she has a tumor on her back and she's paralyzed. And it's like, oh my God, this movie just took a total turn. We get some scenes of Rhonda like doing like very difficult physical therapy and Muriel is walking around and she goes into a bridal shop and tries on a wedding dress. And then she, you know, tells a story about her friend who is, has cancer and the wedding is in September and they take photos. And so she starts making a photo album of her going to wedding dress shops, trying on wedding dresses. It's like a very specific kind of
tiny hate, con.
Like, yeah, mini con with like no real repercussions. But Rhonda one day discovers that she's using her disability, using her illness and disability to basically garner favor with these bridal shops and get, you know, special treatment. And so they have a big blow up fight and Muriel kind of confesses that she's just been infatuated with weddings. Oh, also when we first see her in Sydney working in the video shop, she's watching Princess Di's wedding on the screen, like fast forwarding to all the parts where you see her, the bride. So yeah, she's obsessed. And, so they have a big blow up fight. And eventually she just kind of stops dating Bryce. Like it just, that kind of disappears. And then she meets an Olympian swimmer is he from South Africa? Am I remembering that right? Who basically needs a green card wedding so he can swim for the Australian team. And they offer Muriel like $10,000, to do it. And so she gets engaged and gets married to this guy who she doesn't know and doesn't really love. And she invites, the Mean Girls and Rhonda to be bridesmaids. The Mean Girls, of course, are like, yes, let's be bridesmaids. We can start some drama. Rhonda's like, nope. And they have a wedding. I'm like, oh, that was Muriel's wedding. This is the title of the movie.
It's Muriel's wedding because there is like a title card. Where I will say I was very close to having I Do, I Do, I Do as my like wedding entrance song.
I hadn't even thought of it, but then it was like, of course that's the entrance song.
And it's so good. And you can tell like the groom was not prepared.
But I was also like, that's a good wedding song because That's a fast-paced song, and it forces everyone to come down the aisle quickly because, honestly, that whole tradition of let's all walk down the aisle so slowly so everyone can stare at us and then be like, when are we starting this wedding? That is a weird thing. I get it for the bride. Bride's in a beautiful dress, maybe even groom the tux, but, like, we don't need to see the whole party walking at their slowest pace. So I was like, yeah, I do. Let's get this moving. Let's have this wedding. We had, Tori Rose of Tori Rose and the Hot Mess. If you're in San Diego, check out, if you're in anywhere, their music is on the internet. They're great. And a friend of ours from high school, and Tori Rose sang at our wedding for Jenna to walk down the aisle.
That's lovely.
So she ends up marrying this swimmer, and they're clearly like, not happy, but she's happy that she's been a bride and she's happy that she's married. That's kind of just what she's wanted. I think Muriel doesn't even see her at the wedding, if I remember correctly. It's like she is like she
Rhonda?
Rhonda, yeah.
Well, like she sees her at the very end because she's smoking behind a corner of the church.
That's right, yeah. But yeah, so mom was, oh, and the dad is there with Deidre. And dad has now been, at some point,
he's like sort of moved out, sort of separated. He's living with Deidre.
Yeah, but has the investigation against him started?
I don't know, but it basically does now.
Yeah, around this time, and they open an investigation into, like, you know, him to bribery, you know, being corrupt, like a corruption investigation. And he moves out and starts hanging out with Deidre, who is very clearly, like, they're together. So then we're a little bit of the time overlap is different, confusing for me. But eventually we see we're back in Porpoise Spit and the mom is shopping and she shoplifts a pair of sandals, which I think is supposed to make you realize that she also shoplifted the dress.
I don't think so. I think no. She's just – she doesn't remember. Like it's I could see her just like putting the slippers on because her feet hurt. And then, you know, she keeps walking around the store and doesn't remember that she changed into them.
Yeah. And of course, the same woman from the wedding who ratted out Muriel and said she stole the dress, rats out the mom, says she stole the sandals. Bill, the dad has to come pick her up and he gets really mad at her. And he's like, the reason I lost my campaign is because my family is not up to par. I want a divorce. I'm marrying Deidre. I'm out of here. And he leaves. And then mom yells at one of the sons to get off his ass and actually do something and help her and clean up the house. And then he like hits her. Like it gets very dramatic. Like she hits him. He hits her. It's not like full punches. It's like whacking with newspapers and stuff, but it's still like, oh, Jesus. And then we see her kind of go into the kitchen, which is the first place we see her, which is like her dark place, I feel. And then we go back to Muriel. She gets a call from her sister saying her mom is dead. It's like, oh, shit. Okay. So she comes home. The family's kind of in mourning. The mom has burnt the backyard down because it was all tumbleweeds and tangled and no one ever mowed the lawn or cleaned it like she asked them to. And then the sister says, everyone says it was a heart attack, but I found some empty bottles of sleeping pills next to her bed. And then after more people were in the room, the pills were gone. And they said, you know, they're just trying to hide the fact that she committed suicide. And they show her, she shows her this photo album she had where clearly mom was really proud of her kids and has all these photos of them, and then at the end has all these newspaper clippings from Muriel's wedding. So that scene actually got me like kind of misty. Like it was a very like earnest, thoughtful scene. At the funeral, at the mom's funeral, basically like David, Muriel's husband and her finally have like I think they finally have sex for the first time. Mm-hmm. I don't think they had had sex.
No.
And then Muriel asks for a divorce because she realizes that they don't love each other and that this was all kind of a, you know, which it was a plot. It was a plan. And then Bill tells Muriel that she needs to help raise the rest of the siblings because he's got to focus on his career and they're a liability. And he's lost his city council job and things are not going great for him. And she's like, no, you're
the dad. Be the dad.
Yeah, you're the dad. Be the dad. Like, and she says something along the lines of like, because he's like very much of a blame everybody else type. And she's like, this is your fault too. Like, you were never there. You never did the thing you're supposed to do as a dad. And so she gives him a check for some of the money that she stole and promises to pay off the rest of it. And then she goes to Rhonda's house where,
and jailbreaks her.
Yeah. And jailbreaks her because she's like kind of trapped in this. It looks like a purgatory of dealing with the mean girls who are just there and to be like mom. Condescending and her mom.
And I think kind of like both the mean girls and her mom are that sort of overwhelming, technically well-meaning, the worst kind of well-meaning. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I don't think they think of it as sort of, you know, pushing her down. But that is such, like, you can just tell, like, there's no oxygen in that room.
Yeah, it's awful. And so Muriel comes in. She's like, hey, I was just wondering if maybe you wanted to go to Sydney. And she goes, yes. They go to the taxi. They hop in and everyone chases them out. The mean girl's like, but I'm beautiful. You can't be mean to me, blah, blah, blah. Because they do a big, like, fuck you, everybody. We're out, on their way out the door.
And her mom has this sudden amazing, like, pride on her face, which is like, you know, kind of like, you're going to be all right, kid. But like, in an actual literal way where she's like, yes, this is better for everyone.
Yeah. And so they're in the cab driving down the street, driving through Porpoise Spit, saying goodbye to all the buildings and stuff. And then it's just kind of this moment. There's a moment where they look at each other and I'm like, oh, did this movie just get queer? Because it has,
you know,
this,
what's
like,
funny? That had not occurred to me. I hadn't even thought
they just,
that far.
They're just so happy. And then they look at each other and it is like this moment of like, it's that thing that they do in rom-coms where you're like laughing and smiling and everything's great. And then you kind of like look at each other and it like gets quiet, but you're still like smiling and engaged. And I was like, oh. I think it's just a recognition of their friendship.
There's a more important love than romantic love.
Yeah.
And ABBA and the end.
And it ends with them driving away. But I will say the ending, Muriel, it like lingers on her face and she kind of goes through this like wonderful range of expressions of like happy and then a little anxious and distraught. And it reminded me very much of the end of The Graduate. When
it's funny because it reminds me, now that you were describing it, reminds me of the end of Midnight Cowboy.
Oh,
where
oh,
he's sitting
oh,
on
or, yeah.
the bus and like, you know, that his friend is leaning on him, but not because he's asleep. And it's just like, you know, where he's like, all right, well, I'm off to the place I wanted to go to along, but
It's this history of movies that end with a shot of their leads sitting in the back of a car or back of a vehicle while they head off to an uncertain future.
Mm-hmm. All right. So for the listeners, just I'm going to say that we have kind of a deadline for this recording. So I'm going to skip over some points because I just want to get to what is your favorite character?
I mean, it's Muriel. I like her a lot. I think she's great. I love, she grows like, and I did not expect this movie to become as kind of deep and earnest and profound.
When did you start liking her in the movie?
When she got to Sydney, I think. Mm-hmm. And started having some autonomy. It's almost like she's two different characters.
Well, she also, like, she changes her hair. She starts dressing differently. She really does, like, reinvent herself for better or for worse. Yeah, no, I love
she's
Muriel,
still
kinda too.
She's still kind of awkward, and I like that. Like, she's still awkward and uncomfortable and self-conscious and, you know, flawed in a lot of ways. But she's such a rich character, and she grows.
Yeah, no, she's my favorite character, too. And I think in a whole new way from when I watched this as like a teenager or young adult, because yes, like she has so many layers. Do you have a favorite part? And don't say the Waterloo part, because we all know that's the best part. But aside from that.
I could watch an entire movie if it was just that Waterloo part and everything. And like that whole context,
around it.
I think maybe my favorite part is I do really like this scene with her and her sister after the mom has died. Mm-hmm. It's this quiet, you know, understated scene. It's really touching. It's that's when the movie kind of kicked in its emotional gears for me and actually became something more than the sum of its parts. You know what I mean?
Well, I feel like that is something that, you know, John Waters sometimes does too, where you have mm-hmm. like, it's all kind of weird and big and theatrical. And then there's this tiny little, like two moments of painful nugget of truth kind of.
And I love campy movies. I mm-hmm. love big, broad. I love like weird.
But they need heart.
Yeah. And I think like I kind of wrestled with this movie for a lot of it, but that, even though that comes towards the end, it really was like, it changed my view of the whole movie. So I'd like say
anchored
like,
it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's probably my second favorite part. What about you?
No, I mean, if I can't say ABBA either, I think I just love her and Rhonda in general. So I think like yeah. Rhonda on the island, just like that whole, that second yeah. where Muriel thinks she's going to be abandoned and she's like,
yes, no, that's a great this scene shit. Too. Yeah.
All right. So on Rotten Tomatoes, this has a 78% fresh rating from critics and an 84% from audiences and a 7.2 on IMDb. Wow as in low or wow as in high?
High. I mean, it's a weird movie. I guess I just never understood kind of what a phenomenon it was.
Mm-hmm. What would you give this out of 10 bouquets?
I would, you know, this is hard. Coming to it totally fresh, it kept surprising me. I kept trying to figure out what kind of movie I was watching.
In a good way or in a bad way?
In both. Mm-hmm. But I think like by the time it ended, I felt like I had seen a character in a way that I think chick flicks, rom-coms, I think don't often let their characters grow in this kind of act, in this kind of deep way.
You know what I think you experienced when a movie turns into a film?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to give it an 8. I really liked it.
Yeah, same. Like an 8, possibly a 9, but like, it's funny because I'm like, part of that is nostalgia, but part of that is also that it has more depth with my aging, which is weird. Yeah. But I have to admit that I kept thinking, and I couldn't really think of like fixes that weren't just like, well, this, you know, like it would change it too much. Like there are things that I could do that, again, I would be really interested in the movie where she goes somewhere else. But I just think I don't want to fix it, and I can't think of anything that would make it weirder in a way that's fun and wouldn't just be like screwing with it because that's the premise of this podcast.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
I have two things. One of them is I just read that, and I will preface this by saying Ridley Scott is kind of a monster in a lot of ways.
Oh, that this is his favorite movie?
Yes. If you don't understand why Ridley Scott is a monster, look up what he said about his movie Noah. I think it was Noah, one of his biblical movies where he was, and it was like, well, this all takes place in the Middle East. Why are there no brown people? And he said, well, you can't mount a $1 million picture with Muhammad. Oh no, it was the Ramses story, mm-hmm. Exodus. And he said, we can't mount a multi-million dollar picture with Muhammad such and such from so and so. I'm like, oh, you're a piece of shit.
And I love when then within just a few years they get proven wrong, kind of like how the Sex and the City movie was like, yes. Oh, you can't make money off a woman-led picture. And it's like, haha, yes you can.
Yeah,
anyway,
exactly. I love it when that kind of stuff happens. But yeah, he says Muriel's Wedding, I've seen it 6 times, fantastic. And then in a roundtable for Hollywood Reporter, he said that this would be the one film he'd save if the world was annihilated. That's
I take it back. There are so many Make It Weirds here, and I think I see where you're going with this.
well, no, I'm not doing that. But I just read that, and I was like, oh my god, that's insane. My Make It Weird was I just kept thinking of this as a prequel to Hereditary, which is the Toni Collette really creepy Ari Aster movie. If you've ever seen it, it's absolutely mind trippy horror, but horror thriller, psychological. It's all these weird things,
like weird family intrigue. That is very weird, and I like both like it and hate it at the same time.
But the thing about Hereditary is that movie also like keeps you on your toes. It's like it's several different kinds of movies, and where it goes is not the way you expect it to go. And it is about this family of outcasts. So as I was watching it, I was like thinking, like, this is not that far off.
That's and really interesting.
The fact that in, I mean, the timelines don't match up because the Hereditary is all about the grandma dies, you know, at the early on. And that's one of the
timey-wimey, doesn't matter.
Yeah. But this idea of familial trauma being kind of passed through the generations is part of Muriel's wedding. I don't know how to expound upon that, except for that this is a prequel to Hereditary.
I approve. What did we learn from this movie? Because I think I learned that trauma both is and is not an excuse to be horrible to other people.
Yes.
Like, usually our learnings are jokey, but like this movie was good for me to rewatch, I think.
Yeah. I'm really glad we watched this. And I think I learned that I have fallen victim to the cultural trap of judging movies by their posters.
But it does make for really interesting discussions when you're
I love it, because I love it when a movie just totally catches me off guard like that. And, I need to broaden my, particularly as somebody who does love movies and stuff, I need to broaden my movie repertoire.
Yeah, I think like we mentioned, sometimes people forget that there is actually calm in rom-com, and that can be high quality.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, next week, oh my god, this is such a treat. We'll be talking about Josie and the Pussycats.
A new one for me as well.
Oh, I can't wait. You can find our show notes at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. We're chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. If you feel like it, we really appreciate it if you give us a rating and all that stuff. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.